Good morning, all. Our first case for argument this morning is JMB Manufacturing versus Harrison Manufacturing. Mr. Tomlinson.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court. My name is Michael Tomlinson, and I represent the appellants and cross-appellees in this case, JMB Manufacturing, Inc., DBA Summit Forest Products Company, and Ronald Bienes. This is a commercial case arising out of a contract between two sophisticated parties, Summit Forest and Childcraft. The case arises from non-conforming goods that were delivered pursuant to the party's contract. That contract contained an negotiated allocation of risk between the parties with respect to what would happen if non-conforming goods were supplied, namely that there would be a cost of rework applied and for which Summit Forest would be responsible. But the district court here entered a $2.8 million judgment against Mr. Bienes individually, jointly and severally with Summit Forest, for negligent misrepresentation, not on the contract. This decision has allowed Childcraft to circumvent the party's negotiated allocation of risk here, but it's also done something else that the parties never anticipated and never contracted for, and that is that made Mr. Bienes the personal guarantor not only of Summit Forest contract liabilities, but also for all of Childcraft's business risk in this transaction. For that reason, the court should reverse the district court's judgment with respect to negligent misrepresentation and vacate that judgment amount, remanding it with direction to enter a judgment of zero, because there were no out-of-pocket damages adduced at trial.
Mr. Tomlinson, what was the total contract price for the goods at issue, the ones that were delivered or at least shipped without conforming to the moisture requirements?
That's a fair question and anticipates a point I was going to make, which is the total amount of goods that were shipped under this contract were about $90,000. What Childcraft is seeking here today is about 10, if you include the punitives, they're looking to get a $10 million and the loss of their entire business.
Was there any separate contract between Childcraft and Mr. Bienes?
No, there was no separate contract directly between them. However,
no fee for advice?
No, what Childcraft was paying Summit Forest for was delivering goods. There was, however, a connection, obviously, between Mr. Bienes and Summit Forest, and we see cases such as the library case that talks about a network of contracts. Here, it would have been very easy for Childcraft if the Vogue line was so important to it, was so vital to it. It would have been very easy for Childcraft to go to Mr. Bienes and ask him to personally guarantee the contract, or to sign the contract individually. But it did neither one of those things. First, I would like to talk about. Let me go back for a second, though, because we believe that in this case the economic loss doctrine is a viable means of negating the negligent misrepresentation claim. In addition, Childcraft was limited to recovering its out-of-pocket damages, even if a negligent misrepresentation claim could lie here. And third, the court should reverse the district court's ruling with respect to negligent misrepresentation because Childcraft's claim was insufficient as a matter of law, and it's unsupported by the evidence. Also on appeal today is the district court's abuse of discretion when it failed to reinstate Summit Forest claims against Childcraft after Summit Forest was unrepresented for a very brief period of time before trial. And as is in the briefs, there was a very narrow window between the time that the district court allowed Mr. Bienes' counsel or Summit's counsel to withdraw and the time he was allowed to get new counsel and then the time that trial was set. But the district court nevertheless entered a judgment or refused to reinstate the claims when Mr. Bienes finally did get counsel, and they also refused to vacate the default judgment against Summit Forest that it had entered a few days earlier, about a week earlier, on the claims by Childcraft against Summit Forest.
That was all happening right on the eve of trial, right?
That's correct.
It's frankly pretty hard to see an abuse of discretion there.
Well, in terms of the abuse of discretion here, what happened is there was a summary judgment ruling that came down on April 10th of 2013. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Bienes' counsel moved to withdraw. That was at the end of April. He moved to withdraw. He wasn't actually allowed to withdraw until May 14th. The judge only gave Mr. Dennis about 2 weeks to get new counsel for a trial that was supposed to start on June 10th. He told the court, he reported to the court twice, once on May 20th and once on May 28th at pretrial conferences, of his efforts. But he had trouble getting counsel to come into the case because, as the district court acknowledged, this was such a complex case. So that was the difficulty that he faced here. But he actually did get counsel. And then when he did get counsel, the court still refused to reinstate the claims, and the court had only entered that judgment, which was supposed to be without prejudice, on the default, with respect to the default against the claims against Summit. So,
Mr. Tomlinson, can I ask you, at least one of the ironies in this case is, if I recall correctly, your clients brought the case originally, right?
That's correct.
And sought to pierce the corporate veil of Childcraft?
That's right.
On what theory?
The theory was that, based on some of the things that we've discussed in our briefs, which is exactly the amount of capitalization that Childcraft had originally, must not have been adequate because it burned through the cash in a short period of time. Now, that's despite the fact that
doesn't seem a whole lot more unusual than delivering non-conforming goods under a regular commercial contract.
In terms of piercing a corporate veil?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the point with respect to the negligent misrepresentation claim is that Childcraft's not seeking to pierce the corporate veil. They're seeking to have a direct action against Mr. Bienes for individual liability. In terms of the piercing of the corporate veil issue, that was never able to be litigated in the lower court through a trial because of the default judgment and because of the claims that were dismissed with prejudice. They had the effect of being dismissed with prejudice. With respect to the negligent misrepresentation claim, the first reason that the court should reverse the district court on that particular claim is that the economic loss rule bars the negligent misrepresentation claims here. As I already said, there is a contract at issue here. These were commercial parties. The negligent misrepresentation claim does nothing more than seek to make Mr. Bienes a guarantor of those contractual liabilities. The Indiana Supreme Court in the Greg Allen case also has stated that it refuses to impose tort liability on a corporate officer and employee in the negligent performance of a contract. And that's really what's at the heart of this. Childcraft has argued that they're not claiming a negligent performance of a contract, but Mr. Bienes was an officer and an employee of Summit Forest. The contract was with Summit Forest. If he committed negligence in carrying out that contract, then absolutely this is a claim for negligently performing the contract. And because of that, under cases such as Greg Allen, this court and the district court should not have imposed liability upon Mr. Bienes individually.
If the plaintiff had tried to and succeeded in proving intentional fraud, misrepresentation of a present existing fact, for example, deliberately, would there be a more solid foundation for holding Mr. Bienes personally liable?
If that had happened, which it was not done in this case, but if it had happened, then there may be an argument that he went outside of his duties as a corporate officer. And
that's an entirely different question.
That's an entirely different question, yes. Second, the economic loss rule applies here because there are no special circumstances that would negate its application here. And I'm not going to go through everything that we put in our briefs on this, but I do want to highlight one point that bears note here. In cases such as the U.S. Bank case, where there was a title company that prepared a title and they missed the foreclosure judgment, what is going on with a title company is they are trying to prepare information for the bank to use in its transaction with a third party, its mortgagor. In cases where we have a surveyor, another category of persons who have been held liable for negligent misrepresentation, notwithstanding the economic loss rule, the survey is being prepared for the purposes of the recipient to use that survey in its transactions with third parties. Mr. Bienes didn't do that here. The information he was providing to Childcraft was with respect to their contract with each other in the performance of that contract and in an effort to try to deliver conforming goods. This was not a case where Mr. Bannis was delivering information to a recipient so that they could rely on it in their transactions with third parties. And for that reason, there's no special circumstances here, such as in the U.S. Bank case and similar cases, that would bear negating the economic loss rule here.
Mr. Tomlinson, would it be accurate to describe some of the Indiana exceptions that have been recognized to the economic loss rule to situations where persons were acting, I guess I would say something like advisors to a transaction? That is where I think that would describe the title company or the surveyor in a real estate transaction where there may be a fee being paid by one party to the transaction, but the information is essential to all the parties, and as a matter of economics, the costs are going to be shared among all the parties.
I think that is accurate, and I think it's worth noting that although there are some statements in the Indiana law that negligent misstatement is an exception to the economic loss rule, what the courts have done in actuality is they've looked at every negligent misrepresentation claim on a case-by-case basis. And in the cases such as the ones that you described, Your Honor, they have found that a negligent misrepresentation claim can go forward despite the economic loss rule. But in cases such as the library case and as we say, this case here before the court today, the economic loss rule should still bar the negligent misrepresentation claim here. There are no such special circumstances in this case. In addition, Indiana public policy, and I've alluded to this before, also favors application of the economic loss rule here. And specifically, Indiana courts have said that the economic loss rule protects commercial parties' freedom to allocate their risk among themselves. Mr. Bienes, again, was an employee and officer of Summit Forest. Childcraft contracted with Summit Forest for the delivery of goods, and that's what they were paying for. They weren't paying Mr. Bienes separately for his advice, and they weren't paying Summit Forest separately for their advice, for its advice. However, even if a negligent misrepresentation claim could withstand the economic loss rule here, it could be seen as an exception to the economic loss rule.
Sorry, Mr. Thomas, before you move on from that, I guess the district court here seems to have put great emphasis on the use of the word broker. I wonder if you could address that issue.
I can. There was a case of Jeffrey versus Methodist Hospital that included or lumped in brokers as people who have been held liable for negligent misrepresentation. I did a little research on that, and there's a case. I finally found the case that the parties were discussing. It's a 1923 case in Indiana, and I apologize. I left the piece of paper I had the cite for at my house.
But this is the case that you think that the Court of Appeals in Jeffries was referring to without citing it?
I know it is, and I'll tell you why, because when you shepherdize the case, it comes up with the briefs from the Jeffrey case as having been the cases that the only ones that cite that case.
Ah, okay.
Okay. So, and if you read that case, you're going to have a fun time of it because it's very difficult to quite understand exactly what the court was judging. It's written in some archaic English. It's very difficult to understand exactly what the court based its decision on, whether it was a negligent misstatement in that case or just a failure to some other type of failure. Now, even if, so in addressing the question about the broker is a legal status, and I believe that the district court placed emphasis on that because it had been lumped in at least one other case as a particular type of person that could possibly be held liable for negligent misrepresentation. But the district court was inconsistent in its application of the title broker to Mr. Bienes and to Summit Forest. It also, in other parts of its opinion, referred to them as a supplier. And because of that, I don't think that any special significance can be placed on the fact that the district court at times referred to Mr. Bienes and Summit Forest as a broker. And even if they did, it would be improper here. Because, as we've already discussed, he didn't get paid as a broker. Summit Forest didn't get paid as a broker. He got paid for delivering conforming goods here.
Or not paid.
What's that?
Or not paid.
Or not paid.
For
correct.
Delivering non-conforming goods. So.
Correct. So even if if we look at one other point on the broker issue, even Childcraft did not view Mr. Bienes as a broker. In fact, in the trial, Mr. Gesford, the CEO of Childcraft, argued with his own counsel about what they terming that when his counsel called Mr. Bienes a broker and said, "Well, you say it's a broker; we viewed them as a supplier." So the district court's emphasis on broker, I think, is misplaced here, and I do not think should be a significant factor in determining whether the negligent misrepresentation claim stands. However, even if a negligent misrepresentation claim were to stand in this case, Childcraft can only recover its out-of-pocket damages. As this court addressed in Trickco versus Hubble, the Section 552B of the restatement applies to supply the proper measure of damages here. And those are out-of-pocket damages, not expectancy damages, and not benefit of the bargain damages. Contrary to this rule and in reliance on the expert witness report of Mr. Parks, which was Childcraft's expert witness, the district court here found that Mr. Parks' report concluded that because Childcraft did not receive useful products from Summit, Childcraft was unable to fulfill orders from its customers for the Vogue line, and it suffered lost sales. Those lost sales caused the failure of Summit directly led those lost sales caused by the failure of Summit directly led to the complete loss of Childcraft's business in June of 2009. But what we're talking about are expectancy damages. These two parties had a contract, and they had a contract for delivery of goods and conforming goods, admittedly. But the expectancy from that contract was that there would be profits and that there would be sales. These are expectancy damages in the true sense of the word. There are cases where it's difficult to determine whether it's an expectancy damage or reliance damage. I'm the first to admit it. But this is not one of them. These were the damages that are here in this case were based off of Mr. Parks' report. Mr. Parks' report says nothing about negligent misrepresentations or that those were the cause of any damages. What it says is that the damages flowed from lost sales and that those ultimately led to the demise of Childcraft. In our opinion, that's fairly attenuated. And in any event, as we discussed before, that's far out of line with a $90,000 contract. And I want to address one other point briefly because it was raised in Childcraft's briefs, which is the issue of waiver. This particular issue of Section 552B being the correct measure of damages was raised for the first time by the district court itself, not by the parties, but by the district court itself in its entry on damages. The district court had full discretion and, in fact, an obligation to make sure that it was applying the correct law here to come to a result that was correct with respect to damages. And that's what it did. The issue was not waived, and even if there could be an argument of waiver, the district court had an obligation to correct this misapplication of the manner of damages here, of the method of damages. We also contend on appeal here today that the negligent misrepresentation claim here was insufficient as a matter of law. The primary issue here is whether there was any reliance on the statements that the district court looked at in its opinion. We need to first, though, look at some of the statements that the district court did not seem to account for in its opinion. On November 3, 2008, there was an email from Mr. Bienes. Now, this is at the beginning of the party's relationship. There is an email from Mr. Bienes to Mr. Suvak, the COO at Childcraft, where Mr. Bienes expressed doubt about PT-CETA. Specifically, he predicted delayed shipments, and he also predicted that saw that PT-CETA did not seem to be wanting Summit Forest or Childcraft's business. In response to that, Mr. Suvak stated on the same day that he wanted to salvage the relationship with PT-CETA nonetheless. And that's found in our appendix. Both of those things are found in our appendix at 52 to 53. 2 days later, Mr. Bienes again emailed Childcraft about PT-CETA and said, "Please advise me about whether you want to go forward with PT-CETA." And he lists issues relating to pricing and issues, again, relating to delivery. That's in our appendix at 50 to 51. Mr. Suvak again responded that he did not want to, quote, jump next door to a new supplier. He said that quote, my goal is to stay with PT CETA and find a solution with them, end quote. So we see that Childcraft was not relying on Mr. Bienes as an advisor here. They were the ones running the ship. They were the ones deciding whether to stay with PT CETA, and there was a very important reason that's been alluded to in the briefs. PT CETA was essential to the Made in the USA program that Childcraft was relying on. And if they had gone to even the other supplier in Vietnam that they were looking to go to, that would have completely negated that program.
Why would that be, Mr. Tomlinson? Wasn't the Made in America dealing with the fact that it would be assembled here?
It was dealing with the fact that it would also be assembled. It would be assembled, not only assembled, but finished. And the Vietnamese vendor was going to finish the products in Vietnam.
So that I understand it, its difference is that assembly would always occur here.
That's right.
Yeah, but that the fact that one is finished versus unfinished.
There would have been some assembly still here, is my understanding. But the issue is that the real, you know, what it boils down to is that Childcraft viewed going to the Vietnam supplier as negating its Made in the USA plan. So it knew that if it went to the Vietnam supplier, that would severely inhibit its plan that it had for revitalization. I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time, and I will reserve the rest of that time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tomlinson. Mr. Meredith?
May it please the Court, opposing counsel. My name is Chad Meredith, and I represent the appellees and the cross-appellant in this case. Your Honors, after more than 3 years of intense litigation, including a bench trial on liability and a bench trial on damages, the district court in this case entered final judgment in favor of my client after having previously issued detailed and well-reasoned findings of fact and conclusions of law in which it found that Mr. Ronald Bienes had committed negligent misrepresentations that my client, Childcraft, justifiably and detrimentally relied upon. Your Honors, the district court did everything right in this case with two exceptions, and those exceptions are these. First, it entered damages in favor of my client to the tune of approximately $2.7 million, even though it expressly found that my client had suffered in excess of $5 million in losses due to its justifiable reliance on Mr. Bienes' misrepresentations. And secondly, Your Honor, the district court erred in denying our claim for punitive damages. Your Honors, I'm going to address the things the district court did right here today because Mr. Bienes takes issue with a lot of those things. But first, I'd like to address the two errors that it made. Your Honors, the first error the district court made was its award of compensatory damages. And to help us understand this, I think we need to take a step back and look at the procedural posture, the procedural history of this case. The original final judgment was entered in April of 2014, roughly a year ago today, and the district court originally entered a judgment in favor of my client in excess of $4 million. Now, shortly after that, Mr. Bienes' third set of lawyers made an appearance, and they filed a Rule 59e motion arguing that there shouldn't be any damages because the entire measure of damages my client was seeking was barred by Section 552B of the restatement. The district court took that under consideration and partially agreed with it and cut our damages down to $2.7 million, even though it expressly found in its entry on the motion for reconsideration that my client had suffered in excess of $5 million in losses. Now, Your Honors, the issue here is that Mr. Bienes' argument as to damages was never raised prior to their Rule 59e motion. This is
Mr. Meredith,
yes,
the district judge usually is given considerable leeway in excusing arguable waivers so that the right result can be reached. Was it an abuse of discretion for the district judge to excuse that arguable waiver?
It was, Your Honor, but that brings up a very interesting point. I believe the standard of review here should be de novo because I believe
when a district judge basically exercises discretion in deciding whether issues have been presented sufficiently and in a timely way? You think we ought to review those questions de novo?
I think so, Your Honor, because my interpretation of the case law says that when you review a finding of waiver or non-waiver, the facts upon which that finding are based are reviewed for clear error, and whether those findings themselves constitute waiver is reviewed de novo. But I think regardless, Your Honor, I believe it is an abuse of discretion here, because the rule in this circuit, as I understand it, is and always has been that if an issue is raised for the very first time following final judgment, it's waived.
That's the rule if the district judge decides not to excuse it.
Your Honor, I believe in this case the district judge should have found waiver, because this is an issue, Your Honor, that could have been raised prior to final judgment. And frankly, Your Honor, not raising this issue prior to final judgment has prejudiced my client. The issue on damages was primarily about our damages expert's testimony. Had this issue been raised prior to final judgment, which it could have been, our damages expert was deposed and gave his report in, I believe, the fall of 2012, well before the liability trial, a year and a half approximately before the damages trial. The basis on which his testimony, the basis for his testimony was well known by everyone. This issue clearly could have been raised prior to final judgment, but because it wasn't, Mr. Bienes's counsel were able to misconstrue his testimony and cast it in a light to make it look like he was testifying to an impermissible measure of damages. Had they raised this issue prior to final judgment, we could have supplemented the record. We could have asked our damages expert to clarify what he was talking about, but they didn't do that. They waited until after final judgment, after the proof was closed, and we were hamstrung. We were stuck with the record we had at that point.
Did you make that argument to the district court that we need to reopen the evidence here?
We did not ask the district court to reopen the evidence, Your Honor. At that point, we felt strongly there was a waiver, and we did not do that. Your Honors, finality has to mean something.
Meredith, could we go to what at least I view as the heart of this case, which is whether negligent misrepresentation can apply at all here?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. And you're talking about the economic loss doctrine, I take it.
I am. And specifically, what in your view was the source of Mr. Benius's duty?
Your Honor, the source of his duty was this. He was not under any contractual obligation to make representations about the nature or the quality of the goods or the nature and quality of the inspections. He undertook that duty himself. He,
as an employee and owner of the party you contracted with, right? He didn't have any special individual role, did he?
I'm not sure I would agree with that. Well, I think it is literally true that he was an owner and employee of Summit Forest Products, but I think that I would say that he made those misrepresentations as a trusted advisor to Childcraft.
He paid for those services?
Childcraft was not paying Mr. Bienes for his advice. They were paying Summit.
Okay, I'm trying to imagine, Mr. Meredith, a situation in which, for example, a merchant who sells a particular kind of goods, in this case components of furniture, isn't probably a little more knowledgeable about his products than his buyer is. Isn't that pretty common?
Well, that's exactly right, Your Honor. I think that that weighs in favor of not applying the economic loss doctrine here, because I think Mr. Bienes had superior knowledge as to what was going on, and my client was relying upon him for that. Particularly, my client did not have any facilities or any employees in Indonesia. Mr. Bienes was the only person who had direct contact with the supplier in Indonesia. He had inspectors on the ground in Indonesia. My client was relying upon Mr. Bienes.
Relying upon Mr. Bienes to supply, and what, well, to Summit, to supply conforming goods, right? Let me try this a different way, Mr. Meredith. If the goods had conformed to the contract specifications, would your client have a claim against Mr. Bienes?
That's a very good question, Your Honor, and I thought I might get that question today, and I think the answer is, we don't precisely know what would have happened had they done that, but I think they would, Your Honor.
On what conceivable basis?
I think conceivably one could say that We've got to keep in mind the facts here. On February 4th, Mr. Bienes emailed my client and said, you know, 6 to 8%, we're good to
Assume Summit complies with the contract. The shipments are on time, as promised, and the goods are within spec. Is there any conceivable claim against Mr. Bienes under your theory?
So we're assuming that everything was as it should have been?
Mm-hmm.
If everything is as it should have been, then I think there would have been no negligence on Mr. Bienes' part in any of his misrepresentation, or any. There,
right.
I think there would have been no misrepresentations.
It's only the breach of contract that provides the foundation for any claim against him.
Well, if everything is as it should have been, I don't think there would have been a breach of contract or any claims at all. But maybe I'm misunderstanding your question, Your Honor.
Well, let me explain to you my concern here, Mr. Meredith. I realize this transaction was important to Childcraft, but at least from the perspective of the law, I think this transaction is utterly routine. It's a contract to supply goods. The goods wind up not meeting the contract specifications. The supplier, upon making the delivery, claims that they do meet the contract specifications. All that sounds pretty mundane. Would you agree?
I agree, Your Honor.
And there's no effort here to prove intentional fraud, is there?
I agree, Your Honor.
Okay. So for the last several centuries, the English and American legal system has developed a body of contract law to deal with such cases. A couple of major features of those are that the liability runs to the corporation that is the principal in the contract, not to all of its agents. And the damages are limited. But the theory that was adopted by the district court here seems to me to invite routine departures from those rather fundamental characteristics of contract law. Unlimited consequential damages, personal liability for agents of the contracting parties. So I guess I'd like you to try to explain to us why this case is so special that we could affirm here without tearing away a good deal of contract law.
Thank you, Your Honor. And here's why this case is different. Indiana law, when you step back and look at the body of law on the economic loss doctrine in Indiana, here's where Indiana draws the line. If the interest that is infringed upon is an interest in seeing contractual obligations fulfilled, then the economic loss doctrine applies and you do not have tort liability. If there is an interest outside contractual obligations being fulfilled that is also infringed upon, then you have tort liability. When you look at all the cases, that's essentially the rule of thumb. And here, Your Honor, we have an interest outside contractual obligations that was infringed upon. And that interest is this. Childcraft, in February 2009, was considering switching to an alternate supplier. Mr. Bienes made misrepresentations upon which Childcraft relied, and our chief operating officer, Mark Suvek, expressly testified at the liability trial that Childcraft relied on those misrepresentations in choosing not to switch suppliers. Mr. Bienes had no contractual obligation to make those statements. His company's obligation was to deliver conforming goods that conform to the contract. Had his company simply dropped the goods off at Childcraft and left and said nothing, then I think Your Honor would be right. I think that we would be limited to our contract remedies here because there was a breach of contract and the failure to deliver conforming goods is solely a breach of contract. But where the difference is, Your Honor, is that Mr. Bienes chose to make affirmative misstatements, to make negligent misrepresentations about the facts here, about what was going on, and my client relied upon those statements, and it infringed upon it my client's interest in being able to make decisions about its business and about its actions based
upon
truthful.
What exactly are you referring to as those misrepresentations,
Your Honor? If you look at on February 4th, Mr. Bienes sent, and I'll find the site for you, Your Honor. Mr. Bienes sent
Defendant's Appendix 12, the email from February 4th.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Bienes says moisture content is 6 to 8%.
He says CETA tested moisture content on cribs in between 6 to 8%. Mm-hmm. I will have Maria confirm when it is time to ship. Okay?
That's correct.
Last clause is a promise, right, not a negligent misrepresentation.
The promise that
I will have Maria,
confirm. That's correct, Your Honor.
That's not actionable.
I think under Indiana law it's correct.
Okay. He reports that CETA has reported tests between 6 and 8%. Okay. And you're saying that was a negligent misrepresentation?
Yes, Your Honor. The way we view that is there are actually two statements there. One, CETA has tested this. And two, the results of that test are 6 to 8%.
Okay. Okay. But you're not saying he lied about it.
Well, I don't think there was any scienter. I don't think he was committing fraud there.
Okay.
I don't think he was.
So he's mistaken.
I think it is a negligent misrepresentation because it is factually false that the moisture content of those goods was 6 to 8%.
But he didn't know that.
Well, but the key, Your Honor, is that he should have known that that was false because the key, Your Honor, is a mere four minutes before he sent that email, he sent another email to CETA saying, essentially, do you guys even know how to dry wood properly? And he sent an email to his attorney later saying, CETA told me it was 6 to 8%, but I didn't believe them because their word's not sterling. They've been giving me bad information this whole time. They told me 6 to 8%, but I didn't believe him. But he didn't share any of this with my client.
Well, he's a supplier. But, okay, what else have you got?
Well, I think that's kind of key because, you know, with negligence, we're looking at what would a reasonably prudent person have done in this situation. He had reason to know that this 6 to 8% was not accurate, and yet he sent it on to my client as if that was the actual result.
He said he had been told that, essentially, right?
Well,
he had reason to doubt it. What else have you got?
Okay. Well, Your Honor, we get to late February, and he says, and Mr. Bina sends another email. He says, we've got...
there are 78 cribs ready for second PO in cases.
Right.
That's right. What will be shipped on this container. Now, what's negligent about that?
Well, my client interpreted ready as meaning they conform to the contract.
Now, wouldn't in any commercial setting... A buyer assume that if the supplier has delivered the goods they are representing, they conform to the contract? Can't you take that for granted?
Well, I don't know if I agree with that, Your Honor. I think it's not always true that suppliers make representations about the
They can
quality.
Say it's as is, but come on, in commercial dealings, business people who are making deliveries are implicitly asserting here are the goods we promised you. They conform to our contract.
Well, again, Your Honor,
very
I think,
hard to say that's not implicit in any delivery.
Your Honor, I think, again, that gets back to the point of Mr. Bienes, on his own volition, decided that he was going to make statements about the nature and quality of these goods and the nature and quality of the inspections.
Saying they're ready.
That's right, Your Honor. My client interpreted that to mean these goods have been inspected, everything's good to go, we're ready. And again, I know my opposing counsel is going to say, well, they didn't rely upon this because Doug Gestford testified that by February 22nd they had to make a decision about what was going to happen. Your Honor, I don't know what that means. I think it was a misstatement. February 22nd has no independent significance to anything in this case. I think Mr. Gestford made a misstatement. I think he meant another date because February 22nd means nothing in this case. There's no significance to that date. I think he was probably meaning late February, maybe February 28th or something of that nature. But the bottom line here, Your Honor, is that my client had an interest outside, an extra contractual interest, outside contract completely, in making decisions about its business based upon truthful information. And it did not receive truthful information from Mr. Bienes. And because of that, it decided to stick with him as its supplier rather than switch to its alternate supplier.
Ms. Meredith, yes, if Mr. Bienes was not as credentialed as he was, the record indicates, would you still be making this claim? How much are you suggesting that because had an expertise in woodcraft, that affects your assertions in this case?
Well, I think you're correct that it definitely does affect it. I don't think it's dispositive, but that goes to the justifiability of my client's reliance. My client had dealt with Mr. Bienes for years and knew that he had this expertise, and they trusted him. They in the past, everything had gone well. They had even had a moisture content problem on goods in the past, and Mr. Bienes had resolved that issue in a satisfactory manner, and everybody had gone along and everything had been great. So they assumed that in this case, the same thing was happening. There was a moisture content issue, and they assumed when Mr. Bienes said everything has been tested, 6 to 8%, it's fine, they assumed that once again he had resolved the issue. And a lot of this was based upon his expertise, but also upon the trust that he had engendered in my client over the years.
Back to the area, or part of the area Judge Hamilton was emphasizing, for us to depart from what appears to be maybe Indiana's approach in this area, should rely on an individual like Mr. Venus, rather than having a lesser education, just happened to be a good salesperson, in effect, in a prior dealing? And do you want us to have his turn on at least in part, on the fact that he possessed this expertise?
I don't think it turns on that, Your Honor. I think it's an element, but let me say, I don't think we're asking anybody to depart from Indiana law here. I think that our position and the district court's ruling is completely in line with Indiana law. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Are you claiming there's some kind of fiduciary duty here?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's a fiduciary duty, but I do believe that there is a tort duty. Once you choose to start speaking, if you're not contractually obligated to speak, I believe you have a duty to tell the truth or to give full disclosure.
I'm trying to imagine what the Indiana casebooks would look like if for the last 100 or 150 years of commercial law, employees of contracting businesses were personally liable along these lines for errors as to facts on whether goods conform, when they're going to be shipped, and so on.
Well, I think that's a good point, Your Honor, but I would disagree with you that that's what's going on here. I don't think this is a pure error in terms of a commercial error. I don't think this is a pure commercial error. I don't believe that this is simply loss caused by defective goods. There clearly were defective goods here, and that was a breach of contract, and there are losses from that. There were also misrepresentations that my client relied upon, and the damage from that stems not from the defective goods, but from my client's loss of the opportunity to switch suppliers to its alternate supplier.
Were those misrepresentations anything other than those two emails we've talked about?
Well, Your Honor, I believe when you look back at the full panoply of communications in this instance, they started back in the fall of 2008. And Mr. Bina started saying, look, you know, everything is inspected, everything's good.
Turned out disastrously, but in terms of specific negligent misrepresentations, those are the two emails you're relying on, right?
Well, I think that's the critical time period. That's kind of what it hinges on, because that is the point, you know, earlier. I think they did suffer damages from their reliance on the earlier misrepresentations, because they kept ordering goods and waiting for the shipments to come, and they were losing time in which they could have been selling their goods, their wares. But the clearest cut issue is when we get to February 2009, and they're ready to switch suppliers, they're ready to go to their Vietnamese alternate, and Mr. Bienes says everything's good, it's been inspected 6 to 8%. We're good to go. We're up and running. And my client cancels its plans to switch suppliers. Had they not done that, I don't think we would have had the loss of the – had they switched suppliers, I don't think we'd have the loss of the company. And, Your Honor, Indiana law recognizes negligent misrepresentation as an exception to the economic loss doctrine. When you look at the U.S. Bank case, when you look at the Indianapolis Library case, they say that. They say negligent misrepresentation is an exception to the economic loss doctrine. And now, there are exceptions to the exception. That's how I view the Indianapolis Library case. And the exceptions to the exception, when you look at all these cases, the cases where the economic loss doctrine is applied, those are cases in which the parties aren't really talking about a negligent misrepresentation. They're talking about negligent performance of a contract. Okay, that's the Greg Allen construction case and the Indianapolis Library case. And let me point out, both those cases are construction cases. And in construction cases, as the Indiana Supreme Court noted in the Indianapolis Library case, there is no industry that has a greater reliance on contract law than construction cases. So in construction cases, you have this network of contracts.
Or the UCC's Article 2, sale of goods.
Well, Your Honor, that's correct. There's no question about that. But, I would add, but the UCC does not cover negligent misrepresentations. And that's why negligent misrepresentation is viewed as an exception to the economic loss doctrine. And I think another rule of thumb that you look at, that you can see when you look at these cases, is when the parties could have, should have, and normally do allocate the risk of loss on the front end through negotiations, and when that can be handled most efficiently, then you typically don't have tort liability. Okay, and that's typically the case with construction cases. That's typically the case with the risk of loss from defective goods. Okay, and we had that here. We had a negotiation about the risk of loss from defective goods. But what parties do not typically negotiate on an ex-ante basis is the risk of loss from misrepresentations. Because I think everyone in our society understands that at some level you've got to just be able to trust and rely upon trusted advisors. No one negotiates with their trusted advisors as to what's going to happen if that advisor misrepresents something to them. Because that's how one becomes a trusted advisor in the first place. It's not foreseeable that there are going to be misrepresentations. And when you look at the Indianapolis Library case and the Greg Allen case, those weren't really negligent misrepresentation cases. They said those words in the claim, but really what those cases was about is the plaintiff saying, hey, we did not get what we bargained for. We did not get the buildings that we contracted for. Okay, and in this case, Your Honors, there's certainly an element of my client not getting the goods that it contracted for. There's no question about that. But the other issue, but separate and apart from that, is this other issue of negligent misrepresentations. It infringed upon my client's ability to make a decision about whether to switch suppliers, and that's the real heart of the matter here. That issue really came to a head in February. But had we known back in November or December that Mr. Bienes wasn't even sure that CETA could dry wood properly, we could have switched then.
It sounds, Mr. Meredith, as if you're saying that one party to a contract must share all of his nightmare insecurities about things that might go wrong with the other party. I mean, you never know for sure. He's a middleman. He's depending on CETA, right, in his business. And he doesn't know if he can trust them for sure to do a good job. He's committed his company's capital and reputation and put it at risk, but he doesn't know that for sure. Does he have to share all those insecurities with you all?
I think that in this case, he had to give full disclosure about the fact that he did not know whether they could adequately dry the wood. I think he needed to give full disclosure.
And where does that obligation come from?
I think that obligation stems from tort law, Your Honor. I think when you choose to speak, I think you're right, Your Honor, that you don't have to tell anybody about all your full spectrum of nightmare scenarios, because the reality is a lot of worst case scenarios don't come to fruition. So I don't think you have to tell that. But when you believe that there are problems, and it's clear that he subjectively believed that. He didn't know whether they even knew how to dry the wood properly. He says in an email a few days after February 4th to CETA, he says, I think you guys just winged it. I don't think you really have any process. That's all information that he should have shared with my client.
Did your client have any information about the terms of the contract between CETA and Summit, or about the pricing between CETA and Summit?
I don't know that specifically, Your Honor. I think that They may have, but to be honest, Your Honor, I don't know for certain that they knew the exact terms. But I believe they did have information about the pricing. But I think the key is, Your Honor, once you choose to speak, you got to be honest and open. I think they would have, Summit would have been perfectly justified in just dropping the goods off, and if the goods and not saying a word, and had the goods been defective, we'd have a breach of contract claim and a breach of contract claim only.
What if the situation were not damaged goods?
Mm-hmm.
Representation was a delivery on time.
Okay.
And Mr. Ennis was aware that occasionally the Indonesian company was slow in mm-hmm. some of its dealings in other settings. And he said, I'm sure they're going to deliver on time. And they don't deliver on time. World of tort.
I think it depends on the extent of his knowledge and the strength of his reservations. I think, for instance, I think if he had knowledge that, you know, one or two instances in the past 20 years they'd been late, I don't think that makes it a tort, Your Honor, because I think this all goes to kind of the reasonableness of conduct. I think if he knew that they were late 90% of the time, I think probably that would be a tort. So I think it's kind of a sliding scale of issues. Your Honors, and let me add, the Indiana courts have said that privity of contract is a critical issue, not the dispositive issue, but a critical issue in the economic loss doctrine. It's undisputed there's no contract between Mr. Bienes and my client. There's no privity.
Can you point us to any comparable cases, though, where the contract was, where the defendant in the negligent misrepresentation claim is an employee or agent of the contracting party?
Let me think about that for a second, Your Honor. Well, I can. The Jeffrey case, for instance, Your Honor. The contracting party.
Contracting party, yes.
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I'm not aware.
Me either.
Of those. I'm not aware of any case to that
and
effect.
And I would think that if that's a viable claim under Indiana law, we would see it all the time. Particularly any time the contracting party is judgment-proof.
I think what Your Honor is getting at is this a backdoor way around piercing the corporate veil? And I don't think it is, Your Honor. And the reason why I don't believe it is because had Mr. Bienes given full disclosure, or had he chosen not to speak at all, we would not be able to put personal liability on, Your Honor, I see the red light has come on. May I finish this thought briefly? We would not be able to impose breach of contract liability upon Mr. Bienes for the contract. So, Your Honors, we respectfully ask that you reverse the district court on damages, affirm on everything else. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Meredith. Mr. Tomlinson.
Thank you again. May it please the court. I see that the yellow light was on. I'm going to have some very brief comments for the court in rebuttal. When you look at the full set of communications here, what is clear is that Childcraft was not relying on Mr. Bienes or on Summit in determining whether to switch suppliers or to do anything else. They didn't heed his advice in November of 2008, as I pointed out when I was up here before. They refused to go to Indonesia at Mr. Bienes' request. Not once, but twice. They wanted to see for themselves whether they got conforming goods. But they did go to Indonesia initially. They spoke with PT-CETA directly about their specifications and exactly what they wanted. So PT-CETA and Childcraft did have direct communications at the very beginning of the relationship. And then when Mr. Bienes started to warn them about PT-CETA after that trip and then said, hey, you may want to think about going back there again, and because I don't think that they got it the first time or they don't seem to want our business, they refused. At the damages phase of the trial, Mr. Bienes was asked to tell the court, how much does a trip to Indonesia cost? He testified it was about $1,500. They didn't want to spend $1,500, and now they seek $10 million from my clients. That's what they, you know, to supply conforming goods, that's what Summit Forest was contracted to do here. When we talk about the duty that Mr. Bienes had, the fact is, if there was no contract, he had no duty. his duties and obligations were concurrent with the duties and obligations of Summit Forest, and those obligations were to supply conforming goods.
Could you address this question about February 22nd versus February 28th? Decision point?
I can. The February 20th email, there's a February 20th email at our appendix 17 to 18. And that February 20th email is a date when when Childcraft decided to continue on with PT CETA. If you want to talk about reliance, let's look at this. PT CETA had sent three shipments of nonconforming goods to Childcraft. Childcraft had put further shipments on hold. And then on February 20th, in the email I just cited to, they decide that they want to go forward with PT CETA anyway. Regardless of what Mr. Bienes put in his emails, they were running the ship, they were driving the ship here when it came to switching suppliers. And they wanted that made in the USA, they wanted that made in the USA designation. One brief point about the February 4th email that was sent on the same day as the February 4th email that the district court relied on as a negligent misrepresentation. Mr. Bienes was not sending an email to PTC. If you read the email, what it says is, what he's asking them is, he's inquiring about their methods of drying because he thinks they're drying too slow. They're talking about not whether they can get the job done, but how quickly they're getting the job done. That's what he's inquiring about. So there's no inconsistency or incongruency between the February 4th email that he sent to Childcraft and the February 4th email that he received from or sent to PTC regarding their drying methods. And just a final point today, and that is, if this type of liability is allowed, and the court's touched on this several times today, it's not only going to radically change the way that parties arrange their contractual relationships with each other, but it severely negates the type of the reason why people form limited liabilities entities in the first place. If there can be this type of liability in this case, it'll dampen that public policy as well, which allows parties to form corporations to limit their personal liability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Donaldson. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.